Matheson. That's the nothing personal word of the day. Oh. He actually asked me if I could make a toga. I could have made a toga, but that is not truly enough to describe my guest for the next nothing personal. Samson, sit down. We have Tim Matheson, who is one of my favorite, if not the best actor I know, and I know plenty. A career that you simply can't believe. A brilliant, learned man who has used his platform in a way that is making a palpable difference, not just around the country, but around the world. Tim Matheson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, David. It's fabulous to be on your show. I love your program. Thank you so much for having me.
Do you recall when we met by chance?
Absolutely. And I just showed you this. I'll share it with your viewers that too. Then I'm holding up a card from the Expos, which says David P. Sampson, Vice President Executive. It's from Montreal. I was up there shooting. I was playing JFK in a miniseries with Jack. It was Jackie. It was Joanne Wally Kilmer at the time. And that's when we met. And you invited me to the game. And I brought my son, I think, to actually his first baseball game or maybe one of his early baseball games.
So we just talked on another episode about that I was in Montreal and so many things get filmed. So many movies and TV shows are filmed up in Montreal. And there are people who want it. There are movie stars who want to go to games. They want to do something. And so we would get called. And so I got a call. Hey, Tim Matheson has an interest in coming to a game. Once I got through the first question, which always was, well, will he buy a ticket? That's the first question I would always ask. And then depending on my view.
Actor, buy a ticket? Are you crazy?
So I compliment actors who, when they do buy tickets, that said, when I have a love of the work of a actor, so it's totally my own personal preference. It's truly dealer's choice. Tim Matheson? Oh, bring him now. What about his kid? No problem. What about getting on the field? 100%. And that is how our relationship started. And you were, as a man, way cooler than you were as an actor. And to me, the cool factor as an actor was off the charts.
Well, thank you. That's acting. You know, I was, as a kid, I was the least cool kid in high school. The shortest, scrawniest, little ragged little thing there, you know, couldn't get a date, couldn't, you know, I mean, I actually had a young, attractive young woman named Janelle Penny tell me, I would go out with you if you were 6 feet tall, which I was like 6-8 inches short of that. And, you know, and I don't think I ever got to go out with Janelle Penny, but it was one, you know, it's, I fortunately got to play some characters when I gained my height that allowed me to look cool. So then I could sort of manufacture that in real life too.
So when you first started, wait, but you've been in the business forever. You were like bar mitzvah age when you started. So are you saying that you were awkward and not good when you first started in terms of your own self-belief?
Oh, I was, you know, there's several different types of actors, and there's the ham bone types that can just get up and sing and dance and always want to be the center of attention. I was a shy little kid, and it was my way of therapy, I guess, you know, or my way of finding a way to transform into other people. I couldn't really, I was very shy personally, but once I had a character and once I had the dialogue, then I could be expansive. But other than that, I was just terribly shy, especially around girls.
But how did you know you had that skill at 13 before your first audition? Tell me about your first audition.
Oh gosh, I auditioned for a show called Window on Main Street that Robert Young was doing right after Father Knows Best ended. And I auditioned for the lead role. And, you know, and I had been taking drama classes. So it was one of those things that it just felt good. When I, you know, once I got in character or whatever that meant at that point in my life, it just freed me to express emotions, and these emotions that I was blocking off in my real life came out. So I just kept seeking to do that. And I always wanted to be an actor. I think because I used to go and watch movies on the weekend, my parents were going through a divorce, so I would just sit in a movie house, and you could then just sit there and watch it over and over and over again. And I remember watching Witness for the Prosecution with Charles Laughton and looking up at the screen and going, I want to do what he's doing. I want to be in there. I want to be inside there. And I just always wanted to do that. And the minute I got a chance to do that, I just started. But you know, I like that audition I had, I was good, but I'd never done anything. So they said, well, we like you, but we're going to use you for a small part. And I just joked that I was like the third kid through the door. You know, I had like three lines, and the first kid through the door was the lead in the show. And then there was his buddy. And then there was the other guy. And I, you know, it's when I started out doing the other guy, and then slowly built up, and you know, and which was good, I think, because I think it was hard if a kid bang becomes a success right off his first job, because then what do you follow that up with? You know, there was a guy named Jay North who played Leave It to Be, Dennis the Menace. And we used to see him on auditions before Dennis the Menace, and we're going like, man, I wish I'd gotten that. And then after that show was over, what did Jay North do? The poor kid, you know, I'd see him back on auditions again. And it was like, it must be hard for him after doing that show to come out and audition against me and a bunch of other, you know, knockabouts. So it was challenging. And I think it was hard for kids to, who didn't have the emotional ability to process losing their jobs and things like that. It was hard for them to accept those realities.
When I look at a list in my head of child stars and whether or not they were able to parlay that into a career, that is a short list, and you are on that list where you have had a career now. Without giving away your age, because we look the same exact age.
We ain't hiding. Yeah, I'm 49. So it's like, no, I'm 72. I'll be 73 at the end of the year.
So you are you going to have like a 60th anniversary party? Can I come?
Yeah. Hell yeah. Absolutely.
You're going to have 60 years in your career.
And hopefully we won't have to do it on Zoom, you know? I mean, hopefully we can do it in person and, you know, clink glasses, not virtually clink, you know?
Is there a plan actually to start filming? Your most recent is Virgin River, which was outstanding. I actually reviewed it on the show. It is, I can't believe you get to act with Annette O'Toole, who I've loved since the minute I laid eyes on her. And you actually get to be mean to her and then love her and have this moment. What is the filming schedule for that?
We have completed two seasons, and we are looking for a date to begin the third season up in Vancouver, all COVID dependent, all, you know, up in the air about when we might do that, you know, but it's still up in the air. But the second season will premiere on Netflix, I believe, in the fall. They haven't given us an exact date, but it's coming up.
Well, I can't wait. I'll definitely watch it. I will review it. But that means that for sure you are having a 60-year anniversary, because you will be in the industry, in front of the camera, behind the camera. We haven't even talked about the fact that you direct, because I saw you in Florida. You came to a game with the Marlins when you were directing a show, I want to say it, with Gabrielle Anwar, called Burn Notice. Am I close?
Correct. Yes. And you remember, is the only time I've ever thrown out the opening pitch. And I got out there, you know, with the stars of Burn Notice and Jeffrey Donovan. And Jeffrey was an athlete, and he'd been working out all week with his toss. And then Bruce was there, and he had a whole comic routine worked out and did the whole thing. And now I'm standing there like, I haven't even picked up a ball yet. And I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, that is a long way. And I didn't bounce it. I didn't shame myself. It was a bit of a, you know, it was a bit of an arc, but it was credible. It was credible, but thank you for that opportunity.
It was awesome to watch you do it. And you're so diverse. I was thinking you were watching movies saying, I want to be that. You're 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. And then under 10 years later, you're in the toga. So when you're looking right at your career as it's starting, and you're thinking, wow, that's a pretty serious movie I'm watching, you know, Witness for the Prosecution. And then all of a sudden Animal House happens. Can you just give me a quick story how that audition went and whether or not there was an inkling that you would play the role you ended up playing? And did you realize at the time, I'm fascinated by this, and we've never talked about this, that Animal House would be what it has become, which is one of the probably 50 most iconic movies in cinema history.
Wow, thank you. That's high praise. Well, first, they wouldn't let me audition. I mean, I had a couple of meetings with him, and they said, no, he's not right. He's a cowboy. I've been playing a lot of cowboys. and my hair was really long, probably a little longer than it is now. And they said, he's a cowboy or a surfer. He's not preppy. And they would not let me audition. And I had some friends and that I had just worked for Universal. And so they had executives there that knew me and they said, let him audition. Just get, you know, I begged, just, I said, let me audition. And then if you say no, I can live with that. They had then offered me the part of one of the Omegas, like Greg Marmalard or one of those. And I said, no, I don't want to be in this movie if I'm not playing a Delta and Otter. I wanted to play Otter. So they let me audition. And, I had been studying improv to try and change the course of my career because I was playing these straight guys, you know, again, nice guy lived next door or whatever, and just the straight arrow type and had never done a comedy. So with my improv skills or a newly learned improv skills, I just went in and happened to audition with Peter Rieger, and we had a ball. We just had a ball and didn't change too much, but threw in a couple of little zingers and got some big laughs in the room from the writers and the director. And
was John Landis in the room?
John Landis was in the room. And they had us do some more, you know, do another scene. They got really, really excited. And then Landis took me out in the hallway and he goes, you're great. We love you. We're going to give you this job, but don't go and tell anyone until we make an offer. And don't tell anyone. I immediately went and called my agent and said, and don't pretend like I didn't say anything. And they probably told him that I told him. But it was... It changed my life because it allowed me to believe that I could be a comedian and it changed the course of my career because I was doing more drama. And so I've been able to go back and forth between comedy and drama, and it's so much more fun and less stressful to go to work every day and try and make people laugh or to laugh yourself and be with funny material and funny people. So it's just a nicer way of living.
I've always been bothered by the fact that comedy and has never been looked at in the way that drama is. And I view comedy as harder than drama. It is hard to make people laugh. It's hard to do both mental and physical comedy. And people somehow think that a John Belushi or a Chevy Chase, and we're going to talk about him, or a Chris Farley, you've worked, by the way, just that list. That's, you're almost at the Mount Rushmore, right, of physical comedians. And it's hard.
You know, when I was younger, I was 17 years old and I did a movie with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda called Yours, Mine, and Ours. And Lucy, we had a scene in the kitchen and Lucy was very gracious to me and very, positive and supportive of me and gave me a lot of kudos about my work. And then one day we were doing this scene with all the kids, there must have been 10 of us in a kitchen, a prop guy is under the sink popping toast up on a certain line so Lucy can grab it out of midair because it's shot way up in the air and she grabbed it. And she did it a couple of times in the middle of the scene. She turned around and looked at everybody and goes, always rehearse with your props. And, you know, and it was like, okay, Lucy. And I didn't realize until I got into broader physical comedy what she was saying was, and it's an old, they came from vaudeville, these people, and they really knew, they did it, you know, 9 shows a day, was you can't get the laugh, you can't get the joke and land it without rehearse. So it was one of those things, it's not, you can't just throw it off and just say, yeah, it's great. It was just, she was like, she was carving a diamond, you know, and she was so specific and so good. And, you know, as a young actor, you think, oh, I just going to be casual and loose. And that's part of the act too. That's Henry Fonda. Henry Fonda was just miraculous to watch how prepared he was, but just how effortless and what ease he had, you know, and a great contrast to Lucy, but, you know, they had worked together before. And so it was also a treat for me. And I worked with Jackie Gleason and Bob Hope and Van Johnson and people like that. So, and Dick Van Dyke and Debbie Reynolds. So I had those two careers as a kid. And then as I got older with Belushi and Chris Farley and Chevy and, you know, those, that next gen. So I learned a lot from those people early on. You know?
Do you know how much preparation it takes to look like you're unprepared?
Exactly. You know, that's totally it. And it's hard work. And it's like, They should never see you sweat. You know, they should never know how, they should just go, it's easy. Acting's easy.
So when you're on set with Belushi, what had you met him before?
No, I hadn't. For a few of the guys in New York, and most of the guys, most of our crew was from New York. The crew was from L.A., but most of the acting crew came out of New York. And I think me and Stephen First, who played Flounder, were the only two, maybe a couple of the Omegas, came from L.A. And there was a lot, there was a lot of sort of competition between New York and L.A. actors then. And, New York were the real actors. They're the theater actors. In L.A. are the pretty boys, the pretty people, and they don't really know how to do it. They just get by on their looks. Belushi could not have been more supportive and receptive and a pal to me in my first comedy attempt. And just, I think that what's one of the rules of improv is yes, and you never say no to anybody. You say, boy, it's looks like it's going to snow. And you go, yeah, boy, I think it's starting, So you just, you tee it up. I hit it. You hit it. I mean, it's just, we are all playing the same team. So there was a tremendous support from him and which gave me encouragement and I got to know him pretty well and he and his wife Judy he was a lovely, lovely man with a huge heart.
So you talk about preparation though. I'm thinking about improv, and by definition, that's the volleying back and forth. That's a skill that you perfect when you are on stage and you're riffing with the audience, you're riffing with your fellow actors. But let's say an Animal House, did Landis allow on set there to be that sort of improv, or was everything rehearsed? The food fight scene is an example. Were those things well rehearsed? John Belushi popping the mashed potatoes, is he rehearsing that, or are you letting him use his improv skill and Landis was okay with that?
Belushi was the main one and usually the only one who could really, they let go with the improv. I mean, there was a couple of things during the toga party, like the Jamie Widows who played Hoover juggling and Bruce McGill playing his throat with the William Tell overture. That was improv. And but Belushi was miraculous. I mean, he was an amazing performer, and like his, stealing food and eating food in the food line in the cafeteria before he sits down at the table with me and the Omega group. That was all improv. And they just set up a few things like the coffee, like the little golf ball, which was obviously artificial. But he would just squeezing that sandwich into his mouth. That's all John, it was just, and I believe it's one take. I don't think he did that more than once. And he just had an ability to know that what was real and funny. And he just, and he'd been doing it so long that he could, and he was such a great physical comedian. And, if you realize that part, he had very few lines. And that was a great concern to him initially that I don't, and he didn't really have much, hardly any dialogue. But what he was, as John Landis always described him, was the cookie monster. He was this wild spirit, but with heart, he was like Chico Marx, and the Marx Brothers. He just was this indomitable spirit, but with filled with love. And that's who he was. And Landis always said to us, they have to like you guys, that was his addition to the whole script. Was originally, it was all this crazy comedy college stuff. But when Landis read the script, he said, I didn't like them. I didn't like these guys. They were, and he just said, you can't be mean to each other. You can't be mean to anybody. So that was the thing that we all found, that was the difference between us and the Omegas,
Do you know that we get, as part of putting on baseball games, we have in-game entertainment. You've seen it wherever you go. And you have a Jumbotron. And at certain parts in the game, we have people do certain things, certain clips that get the crowd excited, whether it's a save situation or a home run. You're aware of your role in the sports pantheon, or are you not? You've been to a bunch of games. Have you been to a game with your son and looked up and seen yourself as part of Animal House giving a speech where you then say, let it go? Have you nothing?
Yes, I've seen it once. So now, which clip did you guys use?
We used one about the Germans bombing Pearl Harbor. That's it. It's when you're down two runs in the ninth, that's the go-to. You stand up and say, was it over? Just let him go. Because it's so perfect. And what I love, it's an inside joke because half of the fans are like, well, what was wrong with that?
Jesus. That is perfect. So... They, the one they should have used was, hey, you fucked up, you trusted us. I mean, come on.
But no, the problem is people use that about me and they're wrong. So I got to segue because I have a question. You're working with Belushi. Belushi dies of a drug overdose. Crushing. You then work with Chris Farley on a movie. You take your life experience because you're not the young. I mean, you were still young, but not the young guy on set in that movie by any stretch. Not old, but you see Chris Farley. You know Chris Farley has stated that he views his life as the second coming of John Belushi. He said it in interviews and personally. Did you see what was going on that set? Did you see what the future was with Chris? How did you, I think about you a lot, Tim, because while working with these geniuses, these brilliant actors, there's also there's a dark side. And there's something where that longevity that you've had is not likely to happen. How do you come to grips with that? Do you speak to Chris? Did you speak to Chris? Tell me about that.
Well, Chris was reverential about Animal House and about John Belushi. And I had an audition at Paramount. I did audition for it. You know, they called me in and Chris was there. And he did everything but roll out a red carpet, you know, and he just was so beside himself to meet me. And he just, you know, I was like, you know, Chris, I mean, Jesus. Look, I mean, you're Chris Farley. Are you kidding me? I mean, he just was so gracious and so wonderful about it and just quoted the lines and asked about Belushi and asked about that experience. And we hit it off and we had a good audition and reading. I don't think there were anybody else they were thinking about it. They just probably just wanted to see us both together to see they could play brothers. Sure, sure. But Chris was on his best behavior when we shot that, you know, he didn't drink and he was going to AA and so he was really on his best behavior and he was just an indomitable performer and it was one of the most wonderful things to watch him. We had a scene where I was doing like a campaign speech, like a rally or something. There must've been 250 background artists to play the crowd, you know, and they were there and, you know, and it's hard work where they're bored. They're standing outside in the sun all day. And Chris between takes would get up and he actually did a strip tease and, you know, and was doing one of his characters for them and just knocked them out. You know, they were crazy with laughter between takes just so that they would stay in it. And he just loved to perform and loved to amuse people and make people laugh and feel good. The one thing that made me a little nervous was he chain smoked through the whole, you know, off camera. I mean, never didn't have a cigarette in his mouth. And so he was like, really, I just, wow, he's really smoking. And he also drank coffee, iced coffee that was like this big. And he had an assistant who would give him one of those. And I'm not saying every take, but every scene, let's say he drank two or three of those. I mean, you know, you do 20 scenes a day, 10 scenes a day. I mean, that's a lot of coffee. And he's overweight. I'm just thinking, just poor heart, you don't want to be drinking that much coffee, you know? I'd make the joke to him. I said, it's a good thing you're clean. You know, like I can just, you know, you got these passions, I think, you know, and I'm glad you're not doing drugs and alcohol right now, you know, period. And I didn't know that he had gotten back on. And then, you know, when I heard he passed, but it was a grave, grave loss. And it, those guys that are like Belushi and he, they're so famous and people want to party with them, you know? And so part of the thing is anytime anybody spots them here, come on, have a drink. Let's have some, you know, Coke, let's do whatever, you know? And so I think they just never got to that point in their life where somebody became so important to them that they settled down. They wanted to raise a family. That didn't really enter into his mind perhaps, but couldn't have been more sweet and loving. What a dear, dear man who just also revered the spirit of John Belushi and he knew he had a talent and wanted to share it with everybody. And he just wanted to make people laugh. I mean, he was a dear, dear man.
Didn't he die the same age as John Belushi? Am I making that up?
Yeah, I think you're right. Exactly right. Same age.
And it almost became like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you bring up something that it has to be mentioned. When you're famous and people want a piece of you, you just said, how do you turn down? Someone wants a drink. Someone wants you to do coke. Someone wants you to go out, do something. I understand that point and what you're saying. On the other hand, there are people who are as famous who find a way to deal with that. Not by doing drugs every time. It's the famous thing when you buy you've seen it in movies, you buy a girl a drink and she's putting the shoppie right behind her head.
You've seen it 1,000 times, I think, with athletes. I mean, you how do they do it? I mean,
so for them, it's just point out, for athletes, it's different. They're not being offered drugs and drinks all the time. They're being offered women all the time.
And drugs and drinks. So, I mean, you're right. But I mean, it's a party. Every time you go to a new city, you're on the road, you go to a city. I mean, I knew some basketball players when I was up in Vancouver back in like 99 and 01, I believe, when the Grizzlies were there, you know, and I knew a couple of the players and, you know, went to a lot of games and, you know, and they lived in my building. And the day after a game, mostly the entourage, you know, of the players were, but they partied all night and they lived down the hall from me so I could hear them. And it was like, the players themselves usually just went and worked out. I never saw them party that much, but, you know.
You were never invited to one of the parties and you were on their hall, on their floor?
I'd gone a couple of times, but if I had to work or something, I couldn't go. You know, I mean, I went over a couple of times, but
they had to work also. They had a game.
Yeah, but you know, it's an evening game. It's like, but it was interesting. I said, I don't know how they do it. I just don't know how they do it.
Always on the go with your busy work schedule? Trying to find a healthy option of food choices that you can pack and eat at the office? Look no further than Factor Meals. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. It's all ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular ones like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan, or Veggie. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages, all that will help you stay fueled and feel good throughout the day. Get started right now and fuel up for your springtime goals. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can pause, reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/Samson50 and use code Samson50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code Samson50. SAMSON50 at factormeals.com/Samson50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Trust me, they're good. So when you're a physical comedian like a Chris Farley, it's interesting what we do. I was thinking about Jonah Hill, or some people are saying Seth Rogen is in this category, that weight is a part of their look and their humor, and you have to reintroduce yourself as an actor when you lose weight or when you gain weight. You know, like Jonah Hill, he lost weight. He's not as funny. Chris Farley doing the Chippendale striptease with Patrick Swayze, right? Part of the humor of that is Chris Farley's body. So I imagine, and I've witnessed this, where actors say, this is the character I'm playing, but they forget that when the camera's not rolling, they don't have to play that character because in their mind, the camera is always rolling. Yeah. And how do you get the camera to stop rolling? Because you've done it. You're 63 years in the business, or 60 years in the business, I mean. You have gone in and out of comedy, been incredibly successful. What is it, the secret that you have that others didn't?
Well, I tried, you know, I mean, as I sort of grew up in the business, and I went, you know, like from a kid acting, and then I did a lot of cartoon voice work. I was Johnny Quest for Hanna-Barbera and did a bunch of different things like that. And then I was in the Virginian, Bonanza, and The Quest, which were three Western television shows. I did a year in each one. I killed the Virginian, I killed Bonanza, and then I did The Quest for 1 year with Kurt Russell, who is a kid actor and an athlete, is one of the super, you know, greatest guys. You probably know Kurt, and, you know, he's a wonderful, wonderful man and a funny guy, and knows not to take himself or this business too seriously, and which is it was a lesson I learned working with him. I just think that it's important just to keep it light and have a good time.
It's not as easy. And I was just, you know, I'm going through in my mind all the things that we've talked about when we're not recording a show versus things that we're talking about now. I've never asked you even about Ryan Reynolds, another one of my favorite movies that you were in, Van Wilder. And that was before Ryan Reynolds became, I mean, Ryan Reynolds is epic and huge now. And he was just beginning. You've been a part, maybe you are the string that is used by everybody behind the camera, in front of the camera, because you're like this sage. Is that your role, Tim?
Well, that's a very nice way of looking at it. I appreciate it. I didn't know who Ryan was when I got that movie and when they offered it to me, but I did my homework and I looked at his show. I think he was in Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza thing or whatever. It was a sitcom, and I watched the show, and I watched him. I said, well, he's funny. He's, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's good. And then when I met him, he was, first, he's Canadian. So he's like this, you know, he's like just a good, solid guy. You know, he's a real guy. Didn't take himself too seriously. He doesn't, you know, he's not all puffed up about himself. And he studies comedy. He studies what he does. He had studied Fletch. He had asked me all these questions about Chevy and Belushi and Animal House and, you know, what about, you know, and tell me about Up the Creek. I had done this movie. And he's just like, so he's a student of the work, of the comedy. And he's a very, very hard worker. And so when I looked, you'd work with him in the scene and he was very, you know, he's quick and he's fast and he's, you know, he could repeat himself. And so he's a real pro. He's really good. And he's very funny and relaxed and smart. And I said, yep, I believe in this guy. I think big things are going to happen for him. I mean, it's like you meet somebody, like I'm sure with pro athletes, you look at him and you go, this is going to be big, you know. The first time I went to an Astros game and I saw, there was a rookie, that I'll tell you how long ago it was in the Astrodome, and it was Craig Biggio, was a rookie, and he was catcher then, I think. Right. And I just, he had, his, you know, he was like 2 for 3 or 3 for 4 that day. And it's like his opening day. And it was like, geez, this kid is, and he's a catcher, you know? And it was like, oh my God, you know, you could just tell there was something about him. Well, Ryan Reynolds was that way.
He's so Craig Biggio, that's funny. He's obviously in the Hall of Fame and you've touched on baseball. Is baseball your favorite sport?
Yeah, I'd say so. Absolutely.
So you go to NBA, when you're on set, on location, do you go to whatever professional sports are going on in that location?
Sure. I mean, I love hockey. I love watching hockey games, and then we get a lot of that up in Vancouver. And there was basketball in Vancouver for a minute. And basketball. I love watching, you know, NBA games, certainly. I mean, there's something about being in the room or the auditorium where an NBA game's going on, and just to see the level that these athletes are playing at, and
it's so fast, isn't it? They're so big and it's so fast.
Yeah. And baseball, I don't, you know, there's just something about baseball that is that pace, and, you know, how do you describe what that is? It's very American. It's very, it's just heartwarming for me. I just love to go. And I must say the best baseball games that I think I've ever seen. I took my son and went to Phoenix and went to Scottsdale for spring training 1 year. And those are the most fun games. I mean, you know, cause there's like 3,000 people or 2,500 people. It's not sold out. It's like just people and you can talk to the players. They throw balls to the kids all the time. And it's just, it's to me, and I'm wondering what you think the season will be like this year. And I just said, geez, I hope it's like spring training. I hope it's not as crowded. I mean, obviously, and I don't think they're going to have the crowds, or if they're even going to let us in. I don't know.
But well, now I know why you liked the Expos and the Marlins, because you like small, intimate crowds. So that's good. I appreciate that. Such a backhanded compliment, Tim. Hey, thank you.
Got to slip one in.
So if you were invited to a game, would you go right now?
I'd have to think long and hard. And it depends on how they, you know, how many people they'd have. I wouldn't go if it was very crowded. I mean, I'm just, I'm the target audience for COVID-19, you know. So I just, we're in total isolation now. This week, my kids came to visit. It's the first time we've ever, you know, been socially in the same area outside with, you know, with six of us, eight of us. And, you know, with masks and separate food containers for everybody. And so we've been very cautious about it. I don't think I'd want to be in a public place very much for the next 6 months.
You know? It's going to change the business. So it's not just going to change the sports business. It's going to change the entertainment business.
Oh, yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about Broadway. I love Broadway. They're going to have to make changes because social distancing, if that is how life is going to be, you cannot social distance in a Broadway theater, especially intermission. Everyone's waiting online at the bathroom. The seats are so close together and the margins are so thin to begin with that right. If you're only running at 25% capacity, which to me, which would be a maximum in a Broadway theater, then it's a non-starter from a business standpoint. So I'm worried about Broadway. The movie business is also changing where you're going to see, in my opinion, more movies go right to video, which used to be, it was the Scarlet V for so long. Oh, that movie went straight to video, right? That you didn't want to be associated with a movie that went straight to video. Now, let me tell you, isn't that how it's going to be?
Oh, I think so. It's been leaning in that direction. And the window has gotten shorter and shorter from the theatrical release till the video on demand or the video premiere. And the theater owners are fighting to keep the window longer to 3 months, 6 months, whatever. And the studios are saying, no, shrink it to 6 weeks. Who cares? And it's like, but I think this is going to change everything because I don't want to go sit in a movie house. I mean, you know, and they had to argue with the theater owners to say, yes, you have to wear a mask. I mean, they were saying, no, you don't have to wear a mask, you know, and they made it a political issue instead of a medical issue. And it seemed to me, okay, fine. That makes it easy for me. I won't go. I just ain't going.
Well, you're talking about AMC, and they came out and said that we are not going to involve ourselves in this political process. We are not requiring masks. It took 24 hours for them to reverse course, full 180, saying, I think everyone's going to need a mask now.
Well, yeah, right, because I think the huge influx of people, and I think I was one of them, said, okay, fine, it makes it easy for me and going to AMC. I'll just cancel my AMC, you know, club membership or whatever. And it's like, ding, you know, I think, and the audience speaks out. And I just think not wearing a mask is a political statement, and it's not a medical statement. It doesn't hurt anybody if you wear a mask. You can hurt somebody if you don't wear a mask. So why would you do that? You know, I mean, would you go up to your 85-year-old grandparent and at a time like this and cough them and talk to them and hug them? No, of course you wouldn't. I mean, you'd be sensitive to that. Why wouldn't you treat other people on the street with the same respect?
So if you were told by the Dodgers that the section – the club section down behind the plate, that we're going to have 30% capacity only. There'll be 6 feet of social distancing. You'll still come in through your elevator, and we'll do things for the club members. We'll get rid of the buffet maybe. One thing I loved about Dodger Stadium is I loved the restaurant. I loved grabbing there were free peanuts and everything as you walk out to the seats behind the plate and you get to see Dennis Gilbert and Mary Hart. What could be wrong? What if they told you that they're going to control the atmosphere. You have to wear a mask, but you cannot have, there's not going to be the food service, all the things that you're used to with the price you're paying for the ticket, but we're not lowering the price. Where do you come out in terms of the safety of that and whether or not you would go to a game under those circumstances?
Under those circumstances, I'd go. Yeah. I mean, you know, they probably have prepackaged meals or stuff, and you can just pick it up and carry it out there yourself. I must say, I don't need to have that kind of service to enjoy a baseball game. And it's probably better if I don't, you know, I think you came up with us up to the Playtone suite, and, you know, and said hello to Tom. I don't know if Tom was there. Tom Hanks is a friend of mine, and Gary Getzman, who runs Playtone with Tom. And, you know, they have food and everything laid out. For me, the fun is I go out and go downstairs and go to a couple of the different places to get a burger and to get a, you know, a hot dog or something, because to me, that's the thing that I've always enjoyed about baseball is the part of it is the food and the different food in the different cities where you go to a game. So that I enjoy, and I enjoy standing in line and talking to people and stuff. Obviously, nowadays I would avoid that, but I'd definitely be in there. And, you know, you pay what you pay. So you want to, as a fan of baseball, I want to help the team stay alive, and I want to help the players keep playing, you know, so I'd love to see them. And you know, I've been listening to you talk about the new season. What is it going to be, 60 games, they think?
Yep, 60 games.
All played in the home stadium? I mean, how's that going?
So they're going to have 60 games, 30 home games, 30 road games. But the Dodgers, in theory, will play their 30 home games in Dodger Stadium. They're trying to get all 30 teams. They got an issue in Canada because right now the Blue Jays don't have permission to play in Canada. And Canada's looking at us as though we're completely crazy. So they don't want to let the road teams come into Canada, to say nothing of the players who had been in Dunedin at spring training with the Blue Jays who are now testing positive. So they're trying to figure that out. But unlike the NBA and NHL, where they're trying to bubble, MLB is trying to just have a season where there's jumping on planes and going from city to city.
I thought at one point, I thought you talked about, or I'd heard, maybe they'll only play like in their division, you know, that you'll play the whole season between Seattle and San Francisco and San Diego and, you know, in this region.
They're doing geographical, Tim, geographical schedules. So the NL East will play the AL East, and the Dodgers will only play the NL West, but also teams from the AL West. On the East Coast, the teams actually get to stay within their time zone the entire season. But of course, on the West Coast, you don't have that. The Dodgers have to go to Mountain. They have to go to Central. Right. So that's just the reality of sort of the geographic regions. And you're talking about the political aspect of coronavirus, which is absolutely a fact. And you're very active politically. You are very outspoken. People think it's pejorative, but I don't. You are someone who actually is trying to educate people as to what's happening and how to understand in bites. As an actor, you're behind the eight ball because everyone assumes all actors are dumb and all athletes are dumb and all sports executives are dumb. And stay in your lane. Don't talk about anything other than, you know, what you can do. I want to give you an opportunity just to say that I appreciate what you do. I know you, so I know that acting is what you do, not who you are. And please don't stop what you do because it matters.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I just, you know, I'm an avid political fan and, you know, was so before the West Wing but especially because of working on the West Wing with, so many, you know, wonderful people, Lawrence O'Donnell and Dee Dee Myers and Aaron Sorkin, always the smartest guy in the room, and just the level at which and I'm a big research nut, so I read Carl Sandburg's Lincoln, you know, which is 7 volumes. It's got to be 7,000 pages. I mean, and it's like, so it's like day by day of the Lincoln life. And it's just an amazing, amazing literature. But also just the American history and that I've studied and read about and care so much about the history of this country and the way it's evolved. I just, you know, and I went to the impeachment hearings for Bill Clinton, you know, and I was there because I cared for the Republic. I cared, you know, I was sad that it would come to that, you know, over such a silly little issue. However, that aside, I just think that it's important for all of us as Americans to be involved in the process and afford all other Americans the same involvements or the ability to be involved on the same level, voting and speaking their minds and freedom of the press. I just think it's now more important than ever. And I see certain things trying to take that away. So an institutionalized hatred and institutionalized gerrymandering and voting fraud. And I just think that we have to fight against that.
How much did the West Wing play a part in this evolution? You obviously played the vice president. West Wing is I think my third ranked. I rank, as you know, I rank my favorite movies. I rank my favorite TV shows. I put MASH first. I put Survivor second because I was on Survivor. And then West Wing is third. I learned so much from West Wing. I have such great respect. The Newsroom is an Aaron Sorkin show that people overlooked. I don't know why. It is brilliant. But West Wing, to me, I've been rewatching it, and I have not really rewatched TV series. Well, I watch Fletch and Animal House literally probably 50 times minimum, more, way more. I have it memorized. I actually talk about Dr. Rosen and Dr. Rosenpenis on various shows. But West Wing is just, it's in a different ballpark to me in terms of what it can offer to viewers. Were you aware of that while you were filming it? Were the actors understanding of that?
Oh yeah. And I think because it was one of those, and it wasn't, you know, when Jack Kennedy was president, it was sort of perceived as Camelot, you know, a magic special time that ended sadly, you know, with his assassination, obviously. And the West Wing was sort of about the noble people, the nobility of the people that were in politics for the right reasons and for a cause, you know, and who had heart and who had brains and who had a soul. And so it was about these noble people. And I think that had a lot to do with it for me. And it was during the Clinton presidency, and we did feel that that's what was happening, that good things were happening for this country. He was a great president, you know, economically and for the goodwill of the people, I think, you know, and they tried to get health care and they tried to do the right thing. You know, he had his own personal peccadillos, but I think that, so that led me on that path. And I've continued, and I played a lot of, you know, political characters I played Jack Kennedy. You know, I played Hoynes on the vice president on the West Wing, who wasn't really a good guy, or people perceived not to be a good guy. And you know, and then I played Ronald Reagan in Killing Reagan, which was on Nat Geo. So I've done that, and it's great doing all the research about those people. And the one thing they all had in common was that they cared about this country. And they doing that job was a life's goal, and they had lived their life and their life had led them to perform that role. And you know, I wasn't a fan of Reagan's politics, but I certainly, you can't act politics, you know. It was all about his heart and his relationship with Nancy. That's what we played on that movie, and about the effect of his near-death experience and what how that affected him. So it's the humanity of those people. Now, you know, that can be imaginary in an actor's mind, but all the reading that one does and that I did, and especially for the research for those characters, just showed me that they were very noble characters, and I haven't seen that kind of nobility anywhere in recent years. And I fear for this country if we don't have that kind of leadership again soon.
Well, that's how we end the show, is with a wait to see. And that is a true wait to see what will happen over this country in the next few months. But you are doing more than your share. I know you'll keep doing it. Tim, thank you for being on Nothing Personal. The honor has certainly been mine.
Thank you. No, it's mine. Thank you so much. And I can't believe let's just keep going. I can almost do another one. I mean, it's great talking to
you all day, Tim.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.